So there's been this open problem within Cartan gravity that you have a symmetry breaking or formulas for gravity, which looks like a Young-Mills theory, but no dynamics has been provided for the symmetry breaking fields or the Higgs field. And this is addressing exactly that question. So I started with a quote by Chern. Electromagnetism is, as we have seen, a gauge field. That gravitation is a gauge field is universally accepted, although exactly how it is a gauge field is a matter still to be clarified. So in a nutshell, you can say that Cartan gravity provides a precise answer to this question. In fact, gravity in this mathematical formulation of Cartan is a symmetry broken SO1 for Young-Mills theory or gauge theory. So then you would expect that you have same structures in electroweak theory. And in fact, so if you compare here, you have electroweak theory. There's a Young-Mills field, which is valued in this Lie algebra. There's a Higgs field that breaks this group down to U1. The electromagnetic gauge group is the subgroup of SU2 cross U1 transformations that leave the Higgs field invariant. The same in Cartan gravity, you have a Young-Mills gauge field valued in SO14, a Higgs field, which you call VA here, that breaks this symmetry of SO14 down to SO13, which is, of course, the symmetry of the tangent space. And the local Lorentz invariance is the subgroup of SO14 that leaves the Higgs field invariant. So everything mirrors like that. Now, a glaring difference between these two theories is then that while the Higgs field of the electroweak theory is treated as a genuine dynamical degree of freedom, and of course, it seems like we have detected it now also, the Higgs field in Cartan gravity, VA, is not treated as a dynamical field satisfying some non-trivial field equations. Instead, people typically postulate that the norm of it is constant, and that's it. And then if you do that, you can recover ordinary general relativity, or rather general relativity in the first-order Palatini formalism. The idea here is straightforward. We generalize Cartan gravity just to provide dynamics for this Higgs field here. And in doing so, we're of course introducing a new additional degree of freedom, which is a norm of V into gravity. So that might seem strange, and what is that doing here now? But if you look at cosmology now, these are frequently introducing exactly such scalar fields to model quintessent dark matter and inflation. So it's quite reasonable to expect that if you develop this dynamical Cartan gravity program, that you will have applications to cosmology. And so in this talk, we're going to see that we're going to reproduce an extensively studied model of quintessence by Peebles and Rathra. We're also going to find signature change for the McDowell-Mansouri action. And this means that the universe starts out in a timeless four-dimensional Euclidean state or four-dimensional Euclidean geometry, and then undergoes a smooth transition from Euclidean to Lorentzian signature, and thus time emerges. So this is similar but not identical to the Hartle-Hawking no-boundary proposal. So that comes out of sort of this dynamical Cartan gravity. Recovery of general relativity at late times can be done by adding an extra term, which looks like a kinetic term. We add this to the McDowell-Mansouri action. So let's provide a brief introduction to Cartan geometry first, because this is super simple. It's just a different way of looking at geometry. Normally, you specify or you characterize geometry by specifying infinitesimal distances everywhere. That's the metric tensor. Well, a different way is just to take inspiration from your bike or something called a wayvisor here. Distance traversed is just recording in how much this wheel has rotated. So of course, you cannot really use this in mathematics, right? So you turn this sort of very crude physical thing into what we might call an idealized wayvisor, an idealized measuring distance measuring device. As such, you just think of it as a sphere. Now we're going to think about this in an embedded picture. The embedded picture is good for visualizations, but not necessary in the end of the day. So there are no really extra dimensions and so on. But it's good, you know, like Riemannian space, you think of that as embedded as something else to help visualization. Anyway, this thing we now turn into an idealized wavevisor, which is a symmetric space which can be rolled without slipping on the manifold. And as such, it has a contact point. There's a privileged point on this symmetric space, this sphere, which signifies the contact point between the manifold and the symmetric space. In addition to this contact point, we also need a prescription for how the idealized wavevisor rotates when rolled along the path. So let's first look at the contact point, just provide a mathematical representation of it. Well, that's going to be easy. The sphere is a set of all points satisfying x squared is equal to l squared. And now, since the contact point is a point on this sphere, we're just going to say, well, it is a vector with such a length here. I'm just going to jump to the next thing. So the next thing we have to do, we have to say how these things rolls. And of course, rolling is a succession of infinitesimal SO13 rotations. So the symmetry group for this sphere is SO3, although we're dealing with a two-dimensional manifold, which we're rolling this thing on. So here, we introduce a SO3 valued connection. And an infinitesimal roll looks like that. Then, in order to get the distance, you need to keep track of the change in contact point. So to make a long story short, you roll this a bit like that. You get the rolled one, and you can compare with the contact point there. And this thing here will then give you the traverse distance. That's the point. So if you just take the difference between the rolled contact point and the one contact point there, take the difference like that, and you square it, voila, you get the metric tensor. So importantly here, the metric tensor is not fundamental. It's a derived concept. The more fundamental variables is a contact point and a connection. And here you can also recover the fine connection. I won't say too much about that. It's basically the rate of change of the contact point. And now, of course, this is usually the way Cartan geometry is doing. But we want to now try to do this construction with a dynamical contact point, which is this symmetry breaking field now. So that means we're just going to imagine that the size of these balls at the different locations on the manifold is not fixed. So here you can think of geometry then as at each point there's a ball with different size, and then by rolling each ball you can get infinitesimal knowledge of the geometry around there. So again, just to repeat here again, at this stage this looks a bit weird. Why would you introduce an extra scalar degree of freedom, which is the norm of this one or the sizes of the balls? Into the geometry here. That looks unnatural. But if you now have applications to cosmology in mind, this makes perfect sense because, especially if you want to model dark matter quintessence or inflation and this stuff. And of course, now we're going to see how this quintessence model and also something very similar to the Hartle-Hawking no boundary proposal comes out of this formalism. So before we do that, we need to generalize this to relativistic scenarios, of course. So in order to do that, we're going to roll not the space, the sphere, but the space-time. And the simplest thing we can imagine here is the de Sitter space. That has symmetry group SO14. And to make a long story short here, if this contact vector is space-like, so now you can have space-like and time-like ones here, because you have a five-dimensional embedded space, which have a time-like direction and a space-like directions also. So if this contact vector is space-like, the subgroup of transformation that leaves the contact vector invariant is the local Lorentz group, SO13. If it's a time-like one, then you get Euclidean manifolds. So this is, of course, what allows, kinematically speaking, that you can have signature change. Cartan geometry is not wedded to a specific signature here. It could be Euclidean or Lorentzian. This is a translational device, how to take the gauge covariant derivative of this one. You find the cotetrad. This is the derivative of this field. I've also put this in the specific gauge. And this is the connection. Here you find. So I'm not going to spend too much time there. Now, let's just go to the simplest possible set of actions we can write down. And those are the polynomial actions, which are gauge invariant, diffeomorphism invariant, and as I impose here, polynomial also. The wedge product is imposed here. So you can show that any equations following from this action are first order differential equations at first. So this will be very different kinematical frameworks. And recognizing theories within here is non-trivial. If you say that these things do not depend on v squared, then in fact, that's a topological term. And that's topologically equivalent to that term. And you have five different terms only. This is a very different theory from general relativity, because you have propagating torsion and so on. So you might come back if there are questions here. The general relativity limit is when you put v squared equals constant. And then you can show that this polynomial actually reduces to an Eisenhilbert term, a cosmological constant, and the Holst term. So let's go here. The first application we have, you just write down the b1 and b2 terms here. And then, to make a long story short here, and there's some technical work here. First, we have to solve for the contortion 1 form, which comes out as an equation motion. This looks like this. And we plug this back in. And we have to do Wilder scaling as well. We just get this action here. And this we recognize as a well-known quintessence model by Peebles and Rautra. This is something like 2,000 citations. So that's the first sort of obvious application. The second application is just look at a much more standard action people are looking in the quantum gravity community. This is the McDowell-Mansouri action, and it looks like this. So in order to study this action, this is propagating torsion and so on. So it's a bit not so easy to study. We shall impose FRW symmetry. That means homogeneity and isotropy of space. And also, we want to see if we can get signature change here. So here, this is the V field. There's a T dimension and a W dimension. Signature change would mean that you go from a space-like one to a time-like one. So you have to cross over here. However, the ordinary gauge you use in quantum gravity is projected just down here. It's required to have zero T component. And then, of course, you cannot get a well-behaved signature change. So what we're doing here, we do not use this gauge. We go to what we call sci-fi gauge for the future. It looks like this. And we also impose psi plus phi is equal constant. So you get this kind of curve here. And here you see this in this gauge, it crosses the gauge orbits only once, and you can get signature change. This is the variables in the FRW reduced ones. And let's just look at the action and the equations of motion. Here's the scale factor. It goes to 0 at t equals 0 and approaches a constant value. Here's v squared, which carries this, the signature if it's time-like or space-like. So here it's positive, and you see it's Lorentzian geometry, but here it changes sign. So here you have the signature change coming in here. So after this moment here, everything is Euclidean space, and there's this timeless Euclidean state of the universe. Now, of course, this doesn't have constant v squared, so this doesn't agree with experiments and GR. By adding a simple, again, this term we added in the Peebles-Rautra one, kinetic term here, you find a squared has this kind of behavior, and the v squared does like that. It goes to a constant value. So by very, very simple action now, this action here, the Mansouri-McDowell action, plus this kinetic term here, you end up with a Euclidean timeless state. It undergoes signature change into the Lorentzian regime. And then after a while, you're going to enter a regime where v squared is constant. And that's where also you reproduce general relativity. Now, this is still qualitative. So we need to still put in sort of specific values. But it looks pretty promising now. And there's enough constants to sort of fix things. So we've seen how now you can apply this theory to cosmology. And it has some interesting phenomenology. We saw how these Peebles-Rautra quintessence models was hidden in first order form within the simple polynomial class of actions. We saw also how this McDowell-Mansour reaction led to signature change. Instead of a Big Bang singularity, we got instead signature change and something very smooth and just soften up to a timeless state. We would like to also, of course, look at black holes to see if there's a singularity protection mechanism within this theory, that now, instead of a singularity inside the black hole, you get signature change. And then finally, we have also developed Cardan geometric matter actions. And they're all first order. They, of course, reproduce the old matter actions when v squared is constant and so on. So they are all robust against signature change of degenerate metrics and so on. That's it. That's an interesting question. So if you count the number of variables, you have five there. So you need one gauge fixing to get a even number. So you're already in a first order formalism. So you're already in phase space in some sense. But this is also gauge symmetries involved. So you have a degeneracy. And you need to do sort of this Hamiltonian analysis. But this is a very good question. And one of the key questions I'd like to ask you, if this, so the Ashtekar variables, they sort of fail to be polynomial.
Yeah, right.
Could this be fixed here? Maybe. I mean, this is an open question, I'd say. So.
So you mentioned actually that you have an extra scalar, but have you checked that your theory doesn't have other modes like vectors or something else?
Yes. So I kept the slide exactly for this. This is a very good question. So if indeed, it is. It has other sort of fields coming in here. This is the first term, which when this v squared is constant or phi is constant here, so you put this in the special gauge here, right? This is a topological term. It just goes out. But when this is varying, this contains derivatives of the contortion tensor. So this is a theory of propagating torsion. And of course, there's obvious things one needs to check. Could this be a dark matter candidate, for example, and so on, right? So, but this is pure speculations, right? And also, these are the things that could destroy this theory and say that it's all bullshit, right?
Yeah, so you don't know. My other question is, if your theory restricts the solar system data,
we're going to look at black hole solutions, Schwarzschild, and we're going to look at that. That's the next thing. So this is basically last month fresh results coming out. This people's Rattra model we got half a year ago, and then made some good progress with imposing symmetries and so on. But that's a very good question. Of course, this needs to be addressed. And if it's wrong, it's wrong. You have to throw it out, and that's it.
Question by Donato. I just was wondering, you're describing quite the dynamics of cosmology from the beginning within a classical framework. This is all classical, so you do not need like quantum effects to explain.
That's a very fair question. So usually in the Hartle-Hawking boundary proposal, that's supposed to be it's a quantum proposal, right? And the change from Lorentzian to Euclidean, that's a quantum process somehow. Here is just a classical theory. So of course you would expect modifications. And also we need to, I mean, this combining with his question here, we need to sort of fix the parameters so it agrees with solar system. We need to fix it so it agrees with the latest Planck data. And then of course there could be changes from the quantum regime, which connects to Sean's question also, how do you do a quantum mechanics of this theory. But it's a bit different, the new variables, so maybe there's hope.
Some work to do. So there are no other questions. I would thank again. And now we have Angel Ballesteros from Burgos talking about dream called doubles.
Okay, first of all, thanks. I would like to thank Flavio and the organizers for the possibility of talking here. And so also, first of all, in order to fix the notation, because we are frequently talking about quantum deformations in this context, I would like to, in a couple of slides, just to recall the basics of this, and just to see what's going on here. So what's a quantum deformation of a Lie algebra, of a universal enveloping algebra, or either of its Lie group? It's very simple. Let's take a sample of SL2R, if you want, the sitter in 1+1 dimensions. Quantum deformation is just a deformation of the Lie algebra. There are many possible deformations of the Lie algebra. And this one is a deformation which is ruled by, in this case, a real parameter. Okay? Obviously, if the parameter goes to zero, you recover the usual SL2. Okay? Which is the one could imagine a lot of an infinite number of Fermat power series deformation of a given Lie algebra. But only few of them, and these are the quantum algebras, these are the quantum deformations, are such that you can find what is called a coproduct, which is nothing but the rule for tensor composing the representations of that algebra. Okay? If you put here the set that goes to zero, you obtain the usual composition rule for tensor product representations of the Lie algebra, which is the natural thing. But you see here, and this is very important, that you are both deforming the commutation rules and the way to compose the representations. Okay? And here you see that here you have a plus sign in the set and a minus sign here. Okay? How could one can these deformations be characterized? You can expand this map, this coproduct map, into a power series and take the first order. Okay? Which would be here the first order in the deformation parameter set? By the way, this deformation parameter set would be the one which in this phenomenological context would be related to the Planck scale somehow. Okay? If you take the first order here, you have something, the first order, which is skew-symmetric because you have a plus and a minus sign here. In fact, if you write it, you obtain what is called the co-commutator corresponding to the Lie by algebra structure generated by this first order thing. And this first order deformation would be zero for J3 because you have no deformation here. And for J plus and J minus, you have the same because the deformation is the same. And you have this J plus minus wedge J3. Okay? Moreover, this is called this Lie by algebra. This generates a Lie by algebra. And this is here is when R matrices appear, because an R matrix is just an object that generates this first order deformation by adjoint action. An R matrix in this case would be just J plus with J minus. An R matrix is something that lives on two copies of the algebra, and you would obtain this first order deformation in this way. So any quantum deformation for this algebra, this is true, it would be generated by a classical R matrix. But this classical R matrix has associated to it a Poisson structure, okay, which is what it will be called the Poisson-Lie structure. And if you go to the group, you construct the connected component of the Lie group associated to the Lie algebra, immediately the R matrix gives you a Poisson structure on the algebra of C infinity functions of the group. In this case, you can compute it explicitly. I have put it just for reference, and you obtain something which, in terms of the group entries, would be a quadratic Poisson structure. And this is the Poisson-Lie structure associated to the quantum deformation or to the R matrix. This would be more or less the semi-classical limit of the deformation at the group level. In fact, this has as well a coproduct structure inside, because just this Poisson Lie structures by construction are compatible with the group multiplication. Okay? If you take the group multiplication, you obtain that this map would be a Poisson map for this Poisson algebra. And moreover, and finally, the quantization of this Poisson algebra would be what we call a quantum group. Okay? This is the full theory. So, and this is the essentially in two slides, what's essentially quantum groups dealing with. Okay? Now, the question is, in general, let's go to 2+1 groups. Let's go to, in particular, for 2+1 kinematical groups with cosmological constant, the sitter, anti-de-sitter, and its Poincaré limit. We know, it's very well known, that for any Lie algebra, one could have many different quantum deformations. That means many different non-equivalent R matrices. The point is, any of these could be more or less naturally related to 2 plus 1 gravity, in which sense and how? The answer is given by the Fox-Rosley construction in the sense that it is well known that in 2 plus 1 gravity, and this connects with Bernd talk this the other day and also by Prince, the Poisson-Li structures on the isometric groups of 2 plus 1 spaces with conservator play a relevant role as phase spaces when 2 plus 1 gravity is considered as a Church-Simons gauge theory. So one has this possible connection. So in fact, among all the possible Poisson-Li structures that one could construct on these kinematical groups, there would be characterized by certain classical R matrices. Only those classical R matrices whose symmetric component has to be is directly related to the adjoint invariant symmetric bilinear form in the algebra are admissible. So we have, from the whole set of possible classical R matrices for these groups, a subset which is the one which would be and which is connected to 2 plus 1 gravity. Okay? The point is to find them, to find them in the case of these kinematical symmetries with a non-vanishing cosmological constant. Moreover, if we find them in the semi-classical level, because I will deal with only with the classical R matrices, their corresponding quantum groups would be supposedly the quantum symmetries that would correspond to the quantization of those Church-Simons symmetries. So the main results that I'm going to present here, I will skip many technical details, I will go just to the result, is to study this problem from the Drinfeld double perspective. What does it mean, the Drinfeld double, this connection with Drinfeld doubles? That all the classical R matrices coming from a Drinfeld double, I will tell you now what a Drinfeld double is, on the isometry group fulfill this consistency condition with the 2 plus 1 gravity construction and are admissible and could be useful in the context of 2 plus 1 gravity. In particular, it is well known that the Sitter-Li algebra SO31 has only 4 possible Drinfeld double structures, that under the Sitter has 3. And thus, we obtain 7 candidates for possible quantum group symmetries that could be relevant in this context. I insist in the fact that the expressions you are going to see now, the cosmological constant is always present as an explicit parameter in such a way that you can put this parameter to 0 and you will obtain the Poincaré symmetries. Okay? And in particular, I will make some comment concerning the kappa symmetry. I will skip this because these are the usual space kinematical symmetries in 2 plus 1 gravity, the Euclidean and the Lorentzian, the three spheres, the hyperbolic spheres, the Euclidean, the Sitter, and the Sitter of Minkowski. Okay? I am going to use the algebra that has appeared here many times in an algebra in which the Sitter, anti the Sitter, and Poincaré appears in a common basis in which both the cosmological constant he here and the metric are parameters. So finally, we have this set of commutation rules. This is the algebra we are going to deal with. R matrix is defined on this and this algebra, in which you have rotations, boost, and translations, non-commutant ones. And what is important to say is that this algebra has 2 Casimir operators that contain these parameters, the cosmological constant and the signature of the metric. And of course, we have 2 Casimir operators, quadratic, both of them. So we have 2 possible quadratic symmetric bilinear forms which are associated to these Casimirs, the first one to S and the second one to T. And the point is that these 2 quadratic bilinear forms are well known to play a fundamental role in the action when you write in gravity as a Church-Simons theory in 2 plus 1. And in fact, the first one is the one which is used normally as the one defining the action, but the second one is also possible to use, and it's well known that it gives the same equations of motion but with a different symplectic structure. And this second form, associated to this second or the first, sorry, Casimir, is the only one that can be generalized to 3 plus 1. So it's also interesting to take it into account because it's the only one that admits such generalization to 3 plus 1. Now, this is, and the point is that in this second one is the generate in the Poincaré. It does not exist for Poincaré. Okay? Yeah, that's true. Thanks. So the admissible R matrices, as I have told, is the, are the ones for which the symmetric part is directly the tensorized part of the Casimir, something like this. So this condition will be automatically fulfilled if we have a Drinfeld double structure. What a Drinfeld double is? It's very simple. And a given Lie algebra has a structure of a Drinfeld double. If you have first, the Lie algebra has to be even dimensional, okay? And you have to be able to split, to factorize the Lie algebra in two subalgebras in which you have one subalgebra, another subalgebra of the same dimension, of course, and you have cross relations between the algebra and the one algebra and the other, which are reverse cross action, reverse action into the other. If you can write any Lie algebra in this way, you can say that that algebra has a Drinfeld double structure. And the point is that if that's the case, automatically there are many things which are automatic. In particular, the Casimir operator for this algebra is automatically the symmetrized product of both things. And you have a symmetric bilinear form on this algebra, which is just obviously connected with this. In this sense, this means that the Xi generators and the capital X generators are dual to each other. But this is automatic. Yeah? And this gives you the, this is the symmetric form that is connected with this Casimir, okay? And moreover, and that's the point, automatically this R matrix, which is again Xi, Xi tensor, automatically is an R matrix which fulfills the classical Jan-Buster equation. Its Q symmetric component is automatically this, but its symmetric component is automatically written in this way, which is just the Casimir, which means that if we have a Drinfeld double structure for a given Lie algebra, automatically this R matrix will fulfill the Fock-Rosselli condition. So this would be a good R matrix in principle to be used in a 2+1 gravity context. Okay, this gives a subset of all possible solutions for R matrices that fulfill this condition, but this is a quite natural structure that gives you this. And what we have done, I will just go to the final details, is just to take the seven doubles, and this is written, the double Lie algebra are two Lie algebras, which are the first one, the second one, and in fact we have a family with eta, a parameter of Drinfeld doubles. In fact, this eta parameter will be the cosmological constant in what we see. And for each of these seven cases, we are able to write a classical R matrix that will work. Okay, I go to the final result. There is one example here, and the matter is just to change the basis in the algebra to write everything. The first double would be this SO2 grand, the dual Lie algebra would be again two in a certain form, and so on. It's a matter of very straightforward computations. It's just the matter is to find a change of basis between these original X generators and the kinematical generators for the sitter or anti-de sitter in 2+1. Okay? The final result is I will go to the final tables. These are the results for the sitter, and you see you have four cases, and these are classical R matrices that comes out from here. Okay? You have that each of the R matrices is related to this is the quadratic linear form which is associated to it. And I have put in red just the kappa, it would be the kappa Poincaré R matrix. Okay? That means that in order to obtain that kappa Poincaré alone is not compatible with this construction, you have to add some twist, at least, or more things in order to get it compatible. So this means that in general, one should consider that these completions of kappa Poincaré in order to fit this consistency with the Cher-Simons stuff. And for this is one. You see that case D contains a superposition of both bilinear forms, okay, so which is also interesting, and that the second bilinear form is obtained in this case when mu is one, which is possible. And this is a self-dual Lie algebra which has not been studied before, and I think it's interesting to go into it. And the same can be done for SO22. In SO22, you have three cases. And it's more or less the same structure. Kappa Poincaré pastis and a second structure in which you have two bilinear forms survive. Okay. So these are essentially, in this case, note that the second bilinear form cannot be obtained because the raw square one is forbidden in the definition of the parameter. So finally, to end with, to each of these R matrices, one should work out the quantum group in the sense I showed to you in the first two slides that corresponds to this very complicated structure. And moreover, for nearly none of these seven cases I have shown to you, this has been done. So it seems that it's worth to analyze the full quantizations in the Hopf algebra sense of all these R matrices. Okay, thank you very much.
You have to introduce this co-product structure, mm-hmm. and then you're interpreting this in a space-time sense. You're interpreting your quantum groups in a space-time sense.
Yeah.
So you have an interpretation for what the physical deformation, the co-product,
okay, thanks.
Means physically?
No, if you go, say, the co-product gives you the composition of the tensor power representations. For instance, if one of the generators of the Hopf algebra is just the momentum, generator translation, the space translation, the coproduct for that will give you just the sum of momenta, okay? Because it would be the composition, the momenta for two particles. For each particle you take, you will have to consider a copy of this algebra, okay?
Yeah.
And once the quantum deformation is put into, you obtain that the momenta is no longer the sum of that, but you have something which deforms in some cases, in some deformations. The composition of momenta is deformed. In other cases, other kinematical symmetries are deformed when you superpose them, okay? And I haven't told one more thing. Of course, one could find the Casimir operator for the deformed algebra. The Casimir operator for the deformed algebra would be a deformed Casimir, something which when z goes to zero, you're in the kinematical case, in some cases, for instance, in Poincaré, you could obtain that this Casimir operator for the momenta gives you some deformed dispersion relation for the moment, the energy moment, okay? Which is the connection, the initial connection that Kappa Poincaré proposed with the phenomenology that connected with the deformed dispersion relation. So in principle, one should work out each of these structures and to find out completely everything. The deformed commutation rules and the coproduct and see what's going on there, which dispersion relations appear.
So you said there's a number of these groups that you still need to look for. There's a big landscape out there. What are the ideal characteristics of such a group?
Yeah. For instance, this gives you the first order deformation, and this is important. So you write down this first order deformation, and usually, for instance, in many cases, in the Poincaré case, the Lorentz symmetry is asked to be preserved. That means that you should not deform the Lorentz symmetry. That means that the deformation that this R matrix, for instance, induce on the Lorentz sector should be zero. This is a constraint that you have to put here. For instance, these R matrices fulfill this condition. However, these other two do not. Okay. So once you have the landscape, you have to fit. To impose some physical conditions, which are easy to impose at the first order level. At this, that such first order level, you fix which is the thing you are looking for, and after that you quantize everything to see what's going on. I think that would be the mechanism.
Actually, you consider the most general pairing, so, right? So you allow for some contribution of this other pairing as well. The pairing on the left includes the T and the S. Right?
Yes. In this case, only in this case, these two contributions appear simultaneously.
And so allowing for the S contribution doesn't give you any other freedom in the other cases?
No, I don't find any.
Okay.
These are the only two cases in which, sorry, this one and the other, the parallel one in the other, in the sitter.
Right. If you take lambda, so if you take the cosmological constant to zero,
this is consistent because in this the sitter case you can this diverges. You have no limit in both cases. When you consider the second pairing, you cannot get the Poincaré limit, which is known because we know that this second pairing has the cosmological constant,
yeah.
and when you put it, it becomes degenerate. So
is there? I thought, so Kappa Poincaré in the limit.
Ah, no, but Kappa Poincaré works.
But for space-like formations, right?
A space-like would be, in this framework, a space-like would be, see, one of these,
yeah.
Because one has to change once more the
right.
basis, okay?
Okay?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Another question?
No, let's thank our speaker.
Thank
again.
You.
Yes. Another question.
Now we have Stefano Bianco from Rome. About relative locality and causality.
Okay. Ah, Flavio, per andare dietro questo, per andare avanti.
Sì.
Okay. So I will present a study made in by Giovanni Marino Camelia, Francesco Brienti, Riccardo Bonocore and me at the University La Sapienza of Rome. So the context of our study is that of theories with the curved momentum space, but still relativistic, in the sense of DSR relativistic theories. So that theories which are relativistic, which have all the symmetries of special relativity, but deformed. And in particular, we study those kind of theories which admit a formulation within the relative locality framework. So in the recent literature, it has been shown how theories with curved momentum space may admit a violation of causality and the global conservation of momenta. And so the aim of this study was to answer to this question of whether relativistic theories with both curved momentum space and relative locality causality in global momentum conservation are still preserved. Before going into the analysis, I will just spend a few moments to review the main concepts of the relativity locality framework. So this is a framework which seems to study a regime in which H bar and G are both negligible, but the ratio is not. So it is a relativistic framework where we have all the symmetries of special relativity. So boost, rotation, and translation, but these symmetries are deformed, maybe deformed. And the parameter H bar over G is associated with the departure from special relativity. This theory is then characterized by possibly deformed Hessian relation and composition of momenta. And then the deformation of the composition of momenta translates in the deformation of the conservation of momenta. The conservation law of momentum. And one of the main features of this framework is that of relative locality, which gives also the name of this framework. And so this feature consists in the fact that locality is no more an absolute feature, but becomes relative. This means that an event which can appear, which appears, a process which appears local to an observer which is near to it, may appear as non-local for a distant observer. So in the sentence that I just pronounced, I never mentioned which is the observer. So that this is a relativistic statement in the sense that this statement is valid for every observer. There is no special observer for which this statement is valid. And so, this to say that theories with curved momentum space may or may not have relative locality, and this depends on the fact on this if these theories have or not they are or not relativistic. Okay, now to develop the analysis, I will study the relative locality framework inspired by the so-called Kappa momentum space. This is a curved momentum space which has the term metric and the kappa connection. And this geometric feature of this curved momentum space translates in this deformed expression for the Hessian relation of a particle and deformed the composition law of momenta. Here, I showed the 1 plus 1 case because this is the case relevant for analysis. And also, we see that I consider just the linear or the deformation because it is also this case relevant for analysis. So L is the deformation parameter, which is expected to be of the order of the inverse of the Planck mass. Here we can notice in the composition of momenta that the zero component is not deformed, while the spatial component gets a deformation. So in the recent literature, it has been studied this so-called causal loop process that we can describe by words like this. So we have a particle P prime, which can be at the same time father of particle P and son of the same particle P. This process is described through the following action, where we can see that for every particle, we have a kinetic term, and we have a term which enforces the Onsher relation. And here we have two other constraints, which enforces the conservation law for the momenta at the vertices where we have the processes. The equation of motion that are relevant for analysis and the report here are just the equation of motion for the particle which are inside the loop. And here we see that the particle free propagate. These are the Onsher relations. And also we see that there are conditions that have to be satisfied by the endpoints of the word lines which are inside the loop. Now, if we study the relativistic limit of this construction, where we have the usual special relativistic laws for the Onsherness and the conservation of momenta, if we combine the equation of motion and the boundary terms for the particle inside the loop, we find this condition, where delta tau and delta tau prime are the proper times of the two particles, and u mu prime are the four velocities. Now, if we consider the component zero of this equation, we see that since the component zero of the four velocities is positive, so we have this equation has no solution with delta tau and delta tau prime both positive in special relativity. So in special relativity, the causal loop does not occur. Now, if we consider the case of the kappa momentum space, we get a deformed relation, and which at first order becomes this. So now we have this additional contribution with respect to the special relativistic case, and we can notice that in principle, if this coefficient is different from zero, we have this dependence from the coordinate of one of the particles inside the loop. And this is also a hint that translation may be not a symmetry here. And so there are solutions in this case with both delta tau and delta tau prime bigger than zero due this extra term. So now we want to enforce in this theory with current momentum space also the feature of relative locality. And to do this, we need the possible deformed translations to be a symmetry of the equation of motion and the boundary terms. So we consider these completely general translations for the word lines of the particles. We will make no assumption on the actual amount of the translation. And we enforce them to be a symmetry. And in particular, when we impose the covariance of the boundary terms for the two particles inside of the loop under these translations, we find the following condition. So this quantity we can recognize that it is the same that it was the coefficient in front of the coordinate from the particle here. And so from imposing the relative locality, we found that this quantity should vanish. And in that case, we found that no more solution can be found with both delta tau and delta tau prime bigger than zero. So once we have relative locality, we are free from causal loop as in special relativity. Now we want to study this different kind of loop, which is called twisted because due to this feature, this way in which we write the conservation law at the two vertices. In fact, here we see that these two momenta P and P prime are present in reverse order in the two conservation, the two constraints, exploiting the fact that the addition is non-commutative. And this gives the name also to this twisted loop, and this we have this graphical representation. Now, if we write explicitly the conservation law at vertices, we find and we is explicit the momenta of the particle which are out of the loop. We see that while these two terms are equal, we see that the deformation in L is different. So in principle, the two moments of the incoming and outgoing particle can be different. And in fact, working out the equation of motion as also in a similar way as it was done for the causal loop, one finds solution with k and k prime different. So that this describes a process where there is an incoming particle which decays, and then in two particles, and then these two particles they combine, but the momenta of the first particle and the momenta of the last particle are different. Now we find still this dependence here from the coordinate of one of the particle, which sounds like also in this case that the translation are not preserved. So. Also here we want to impose the translation to be a symmetry, and we found this condition which is similar to the previous, which kills this term here and this x dependence. And now if we look in details explicitly in this expression, we see that this expression imposes that the momenta of the incoming particle is zero order in L, and the momenta of the two particles inside of the loop are opposite at zero order in L. And if we insert these two conditions in the conservation law at the vertices, we found that now we recover that the two momenta are the same. In fact, here K0 is zero order in L, and P1 is minus P prime 1. At zero order in L. So when we enforce relative locality, we still have global momentum, we recover global momentum conservation even in this curved momentum space theory. So to summarize, if we allow for breaking symmetry of translational invariance, we can find violation of causality and global conservation of momenta. While if we are in the relative locality framework, so that we have translation even if deformed, causality and conservation of momenta are preserved. Okay, thank you.
Questions?
So in the framework of relative locality, particles doesn't live on a universal space-time and space-time are the cotangent space on the momentum space. And just now you model the observer as a straight world line, like in special relativity. Then which cotangent space the observer live in? Or what does the mathematical structure of, so that you can impose the translation invariance by the parameter, by the vector?
I was not thinking about this geometric structure of this cotangent space. The aim was just to have a relativistic theory with curved momentum space. And so I imposed translation to be a symmetry, and this led, and this was the line of the analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I can comment on this. I mean, I think, I mean, Yung Quinn told us the other day about this heroic attempt of having the observer in the graph. But an observer is a detector and a clock. So you need, in principle, an Avogadro number of particles. And you need the coherence, and you need the, so you need an actual clock, and so I think, although it has not been fully metabolized in Stefano's research work, I expect the final outcome to be that the observer is classical, just as it has always been in quantum mechanics, in classical mechanics, in general relativity, any relative locality, the observer is just the observer. It's classical, without any quantum properties, without any relative locality properties. It's classical. It's a classical macroscopic.
Comment on that later, but you said relative locality happens for certain Kerr-Hermitian tricks, but not others.
No. It is just a we can write a theory with a Kerr-Hermitian space, but this theory maybe not be relativistic.
But is there any condition on the Lorentzian space, or could I give you any Lorentzian curved space, and you would be happy?
I think with any Lorentzian space, we can try to write a relativistic theory.
But you need an action of the Lorentz group, presumably.
We need to find possible deformed Poincaré transformations, which are symmetries of the theory.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Any other questions? If not, let's thank Stefan again. Review talk by Giovanni Emiliano Gamelli from Rome. He's going to give us an overview of gravity phenomenology.
Okay. Okay. So thank you. And well, I will. The field of quantum gravity phenomenology has grown quite sizably, so it would not be possible in half an hour to give a fair overview. I have invested quite some energy into giving a rather detailed and broad overview in this recent work. But I will focus today on four points which I think are, in some sense, emerging opportunities, challenges, issues for quantum gravity phenomenology. And I will, give some part of it will be an objective perspective, hopefully objective, but I will also use it in part of it as a subjective perspective focused on my most recent works on the subject. First item on my four-item list is quantum gravity cosmology, which, I mean, when I started all this some 20 years ago, nearly, sad to say, appeared to be the most natural, and probably should appear still the most natural opportunity for doing quantum gravity phenomenology. Cosmology, the early universe, is where the effects should be actually strong, and that promise, however, has not fulfilled. Has not been fulfilled until very recently, and however, I think results over the last few years at least show us that that process was set in motion. And we have heard some of the plenary talks and some of the session talks starting to give us a sense that there is a quantum gravity cosmology that actually starts to compare predictions to data. One thing that will be important in the coming years is to get a feeling, as is normal, what they're testing are test theories, okay, as in all of phenomenology, you rarely compare exactly the theory you were playing with. You compare to data some test theory inspired by the theory you were studying. I think it would be very important to get through development of these test theories a better feeling for how the size of the effects one can test can be related to plant scale features, which is the key aspect that allowed us to get attention from astrophysicists in particular over the last few years, because we could argue that certain sensitivity target was of particular interest. We had a few talks on that, and I will advertise in just half a slide something which I think is also at least equally exciting, which is not so much to end up with a picture where at late times you basically have corrections to the standard cosmology paradigm, but maybe quantum gravity will change the cosmology paradigm completely. After all, cosmology measures a few parameters, and on the basis of those few parameters, there is a big picture that we are buying through those parameters. And in that respect, let me advertise work done with Michele Arzano, Giulia Cupitosi, and Joao Maghegio, which is connected to this issue that a few talks at the meeting also mentioned, which are apparently pervasive in the quantum gravity literature, is the idea that spectral dimensions run. And we had Astrid talk earlier to give us, she also gave us both a review and her viewpoint, so you have even those who didn't know start to appreciate how pervasive are these results. And what we have done exploratively is to take basically what Astrid characterized as the Orava picture for the running of the spectral dimensions and observe that in this class of theories based on modified dispersion relations, if you have, you can have a class of these theories parameterized by parameter gamma. There is a choice of gamma that gives you the number of spectral dimensions in the ultraviolet equal to 2, which is what appears to be favored by quantum gravity research. But then if you do cosmology with these theories, exactly and if and only if gamma is equal to 2, then you have some sort of pervasive scale invariance. And in particular, you get for free a scale invariant spectrum without inflation. So a completely different paradigm for cosmology. And it's kind of striking to me that, you know, just the value of gamma that gives this connection to the quantum gravity result is the only one that gives scale invariance for the spectrum of volume fluctuations. Of course, it would be very important to understand whether this loop closes. I mean, now other approaches should start try to understand whether other ways to get spectral dimensions equal to 2 in the ultraviolet also give you a scale invariant spectrum of volume fluctuations. That would be a very exciting result, I would say. Then some of the talks we had both in the plenary program and in the sessions were about what has been for some time the main engine behind, say, the growing recognition for quantum gravity phenomenology, which has been quantum space-time astrophysics, really. And I think I better stress again the significance of what was told us in part of Daphne's talk, which is that this year we can really reassess positively the ability of this phenomenology to study in detail space-time structure. We finally can claim that we have multi-messenger astrophysics, and therefore multi-messenger quantum space-time astrophysics, since IceCube finally can conclusively argue that they see cosmological neutrinos. And that's the importance in the long term of that discovery.
Cosmological neutrinos, what do you mean?
Not from our neighborhood. They come from far.
Right. Not the
relic. Which is the key for quantum space-time astrophysics. As Daphne stressed, we really would like to now discover that some of these come from gamma ray bursts or from pulsars, I mean, from something with timing. Then we would be a fantastic shape for what I like to call space-time crystallography, in analogy with when you do X-ray material crystallography, this field that I love so much is some sort of crystallography of space-time. And neutrinos would be wonderful for that. But also, we had good news in April. The first news for me was that Fermi is not dead, because I thought it was dead. It gave us 4 good bursts in the first 13 months and no good burst for several years, so I thought it actually died. It's not dead. At least it sees the biggest thing. This was humongous, and Fermi saw it beautifully. And in some sense, this also allows us to reassess in positive the powerfulness of telescopes like Fermi. I mean, this was the most beautiful observation of a gamma ray burst ever. What I call high definition, high energy look at the gamma ray burst. And this brings me to one point that I really feel very strong. I mean, this community has been a parasite community. Others propose experiments. Well, it's not bad. I mean, I think parasites are very economical, and everybody should love us because we never made anybody spend money, and we let them produce more science. So that was very good. But this also says a lot about how we feel ourselves if we continue to be parasites. So other people propose experiments, the telescopes, the experiments are being built, and we come there knocking on the door and say, well, can you look at your data also from our perspective, please? Okay, fine, that's maybe our place in the universe. But I think there are things that we could now do on the strength of the results of the last decade. And I particularly invite everyone to look, for example, at the proposal of this telescope, Gamma 400, which I think, from our perspective, gains strength in light of this observation. I mean, we really, if we could have some sort of a better Fermi, Gamma 400 could be, to some extent, a better Fermi, we could do better stuff. And it would be nice if our community went behind, push for an experiment, get it funded also because we care about it, not get it funded because others care about it, and then we analyze the data with the others. There is one, you know, I really love the whole thing, but there is one aspect that is particularly fascinating to me, which is when you use the universe as a laboratory, you gain as much in the phenomenology if you understand your theory better or if you understand better the universe, which is new. Usually you build your laboratory, the laboratory does whatever you want, and then all the challenge is to understand the theory. I think it's very important some of the things that Granot and Beaumont told us, which is that we are developing suitable techniques for handling our partial ignorance about the sources that produce these signals. This is it's not only a technical challenge that is fascinating, but it's a conceptual challenge. This is the new era, I think, which we are preparing for in fundamental physics. The laboratory will be the universe, and these are the first times when we deal with this challenge of understanding the laboratory before understand, or as much as we make an effort to understand the theory. And so this is very beautiful. On the technical side, there is also a challenge for theories, for formal theories. I mean, these techniques, which are so efficient in dealing with our lack of full understanding of the sources, rely on statistical techniques based on our experience with propagation in material media. And we know that the quantum space-time is not exactly, well, we don't know what the quantum space-time is, and there are about a zillion quantum space-times, but probably none of them is exactly like a material medium. So we should understand to what extent the intuition we have on propagation in a medium could apply when we are dealing with a quantum space-time. Since I took more time than I planned on this, I will be quicker on this part, which is now self-serving. This was hopefully a fair perspective. Now, I go back to some things that, very quickly, to some things that Daphne told you about this burst from April. I just feel that Daphne kept the presentation at a low data analysis technical level, considering we are hosted this week by a LOOPS conference. But for this session, I think I should get a chance to just underline the kind of sizable statistical significance of these spectral legs that Daphne showed us. Well, the spectral legs are remarkable in the sense we find in a sample which is not so crowded, these are all the the events with more than 5 GeV in this magnificent burst, for each one of the highest energy events in this collection, there is some companion event at lower energy within this highest energy sample. If you look at it, as Daphne invited you to do, you see that it's rather striking. But how striking it is? What, you know, after all, you had a certain number of events in a certain time window. You could get it by chance. And in fact, you have to suspect that it is by chance. What we have done here, and it is in the paper, but let me comment it for you. What we've done here is simply, well, let's assume that these were just some events arriving at random times, okay, and see how lucky did we need to get in order to have such a level of correlation between energy and time of arrival reflected by these spectral legs slopes. And you see, this is basically the indication. I mean, you need to, in a Monte Carlo study of this sort, you have a few in a thousand cases where you get the correlation as strong as the one that we found. And perhaps even more interestingly, doubly interesting, is the fact that if you then restrict the study on after 200 seconds, 200 seconds was the main part of the low energy event, but then this is the part where the high energy event was still pretty active and at low energies it was already shutting down. If you do there and you do the same exercise, you get that what the amount of correlation found by our procedure is simply very significant statistically, extremely significant statistically. And it is, well, there are two observations. First of all, I think this observation should bring this issue to the attention of the community, but perhaps more the astrophysics community. We already discussed why I feel is most likely an astrophysical effect, although the quantum space-time interpretation should be kept in mind. Also, this fact that at late times, this feature is more pronounced than if you look at the whole time of the event, to me suggests is an astrophysical feature.
What's the vertical axis?
The vertical axis is frequency in your sample of spectral legs of that slope. So you see this is a certain value of slope, which is about here. And this is very frequent, as you can see. And but you do it on all pairs. You do all pairs.
And the bottom line is random.
The bottom line here is how big is the slope. So
This
means how frequently in a Monte Carlo, say in a million Monte Carlo simulation of this sort, how frequently you find a deviation from of this magnitude. Okay, this is the maximum deviation you expect if you do two trials in 1,000. Okay, so this tells you how unlikely it is that if you just were thrown these photons at random, they just happen to be organized with those time with that time structure. And it's funny that it's actually, and I'm glad we wrote it in March, because this burst is from April. But it's just funny that the slope that then this procedure, statistical procedure, single out just matches rather well what we had built up on our very creative. That one is really creative.
Why do you think this is astrophysical background?
I think we find it's most likely there's a good chance we found something and it is some property of the sources. That's my most promising interpretation. As much as I would prefer the other, but I'm excited also of this one, especially because if we don't understand, if there are indeed such sharp occasional, I mean, for some bursts, maybe this is not typical, but in bursts like this one, there are these strong spectral legs we have to contend with. We better understand them well, because for me, it's important to be able to detect quantum space-time-induced spectral legs, which could be at the level of a millisecond. And if I'm dwelling with, if I have seconds worth of effects intrinsic at the source, I better understand them and understand them very well. So even understanding the I stress, this is quantum gravity phenomenology, even when we understand the source. Because our laboratory is the universe. So it's, as much as it is disappointing for some if this is not a space-time effect, its understanding is space-time research, although it's astrophysics, I think. Flavio is going to.
If there were not the bounds which contradict this, what would you say?
I would be saying the exact opposite because of a slide that Daphne showed you, that when we look at 08.09.16c, we find a faint evidence of the redshift dependence that the quantum space time effect would produce. But that is faint evidence. And instead, I think the bounds we discussed are rather robust. So I have those bounds, and I think this is mostly astrophysical. But yeah, it's a fair question. If I did not have those bounds, I would give more significance to the study of 08.09.16c that Daphne showed you. But that is a very marginally significant observation, which I weight as much less significant than the bounds we have. But I have to speed up. So my third point, which I can go more quickly on, since it was kind of well represented during the session, is relative locality. The second point was something which has been gone for at least 15 years, and in my work, maybe in 20 years. And this is just 2 years old, and I'm very happy to see a lot of progress, which I would like to organize logically, if you allow. And it will not be objectively logical, but it's my attempt to organize it logically. Again, this is, and this is the other side. We need to understand the sources, and we need to understand the theories. And Bernd the other day asked, why do you call them leaf tests? Right? You remember? Well, that's why, because it's not. We need to understand the theory and make them understandable to those who handle data in order for us to gain access to the studies. But I'll take a good bet on it. In order for the deformed relativistic symmetries hypothesis to be relevant in the astrophysics we have been discussing, when I mentioned the second point, is crucial the understanding of relative locality. So this is phenomenology, even when Angel was describing for us apparently formal observations about our matrix, to me is kind of a modern era phenomenologist, because he's trying to help me actually have something usable for the data. So it's a very weird, you know, understanding the source and understanding our matrices is part of phenomenology. Who would have bet 100 years ago? But that's the deal. I would say, curvature of momentum space. The other day, there was a panel discussing what are the facts we had. And I think it could have lasted just 1 second, somebody to say nothing. It takes 1 second to say that word. We have no hard facts about quantum gravity. But we have tentative facts, you know, things that pop out more frequently than others, like running spectral dimensions, for example, and which obviously not an hard fact, but is popping up frequently. So take notice of it. And I think curvature momentum space must surely be pretty high on the list of these facts. As a matter of fact, we have a theory of gravity that we understand pretty well, which is 3D gravity. And Dosey reminded us how a curved momentum space really naturally, I mean, fits perfectly our understanding of 3D gravity. That was was a big part, I would say, of the intuition that led Loran, Jurek, Lee, and myself to imagine something similar for 4D gravity to what is encountered in 3D gravity, with some added element of intuitions from other parts. And another thing I'll take bets for, like it or not, if you have curved momentum space, locality in space-time will be relative. And I think Niccolò gave us a talk just showing how basically the relativity of space-time locality is redshift, just momentum space redshift. So you have curvature, you have redshift. There is no way to avoid that. We had today something which either is a revelation. You guys have to keep the promise now, because it's either a revelation or it's total bullshit. Allow me this, because it's either fantastic or so. I'm going to keep an eye. I hear Laurent frequent enough to be immediately updated. But this is, you know, this would be after 2 years of relative locality to get to this point is a bit amazing. But we heard about there is process in the field theoretical formulation. Continuous enrichment in somehow digging deeper in the literature on Hopf algebras. When the curved momentum space is a group manifold, we know that that is related to Hopf algebra results to some extent, up to interpretation. and we see a growing richness of results based on that kind of traditional, especially from the DSR side, it's very traditional. Now there is a relative locality richer environment. I am personally, and I shouldn't, I'm here to close the session on phenomenology, but I'm particularly excited about some formal results. And those, eventually they will be phenomenology, but now are formal results. Results are suggesting that we have curve momentum spaces which are relativistic. They are the curvature of momentum space is an invariant. They are DSR relativistic, and yet they are not group manifolds. And both Bamburski and Palmisano told us of results that suggest that these things exist. I don't understand yet what is the mathematics behind. I know that Laurent has better feeling already for what the mathematics is behind, but it's something that physicists will need to metabolize, and I'm very excited about it. I'll just say quickly that, what is funny?
No, metabolize is the right word.
Yeah, you know the mathematics, but until you explain me, physicists will not know. So that's the chain. You have to explain me. And good. And well, just a little spot for relative space-time locality. I mean, I like very much the relativistic artifact part of this story, as much as the curve momentum space is a very rich structure. But let me just remind you quickly how to get comfortable with relative locality in just 1 second. I mean, if you restudy in modern prospective special relativity, this is just a C deformation of Galilean relativity. The core feature is that the law of composition of velocity becomes non-commutative and non-associative. Unfortunately, it's no longer fashionable to burn books. But to burn relativity books, I think it's OK. I mean, I'm not complaining if anybody burns relativity books. No religion books, no nothing, but relativity books need to be burned because we feed our students just misleading facts about relativity that grow into physicists who don't know relativity. And the law of composition is non-associative and non-commutative, I would say more virulent than anything we have studied so far on the relative locality side, because then if you study the logic, relativistic logic of special relativity, is really how this observable feature translates into this relativistic effect. The relativity of simultaneity is just a logical counterweight. You know, in relativistic theory, all is balance. You could not have this without this. Okay? Relativistic theory is delicate balance. You have Galilean equilibrium, then you screw it up by this, you can recover relativistic balance by this. And it's very easy, if you want to get comfortable with relative locality, to, you must buy this, and you don't have to. But if you buy this, the logical equilibrium is regained only if you allow space-time locality to be relative. And to me, old-fashioned, an observer is a macroscopic device that will behave classically forever. The only axiom I have. Then relative space-time locality, I can indeed explain the way Stefano was already hinting. So for me, relative locality is simply the fact that processes are no less local than they always have been for those who actually do the measurements, which are devices near the process. Okay? But the inferences that an observer makes about processes occurring at cosmological distances from it can be affected by a form of inferred non-locality, which then, however, the observer who is near the event again regains locality. This is a beautiful relativistic equilibrium. I should say at least 2-3 minutes in my reference frame on macroscopic bodies, because I know Lee really wanted to have talks about macroscopic bodies at this meeting. Ah, it was you. Okay, so this talk is for you, Laura, basically. I'm sorry. I thought this part was for Lee, actually, because yeah, I remember, well, you were very enthusiastic of having some experimental microscopic, and that didn't come through at some point. And also Laura. So anyway, let me just a couple of minutes, because this is a very exciting, I think it's a very new for quantum gravity phenomenology and very exciting developments over the last couple of years. And unfortunately, for a number of circumstances, it was planned that there would be some discussion of this at the meeting, but we did not have it. So a couple of minutes, I'll advertise a few things. So first of all, this has been for a long time. I've been on record for a long time. Quantum mechanics could have been discovered by studying white dwarfs, by studying superconductivity. It's just an accident that our techniques for studying at atomic scale and subatomic scale came first. Okay. If we never developed techniques for studies at atomic and subatomic scale, we would have eventually discovered quantum mechanics by studying white dwarfs, by studying superconductivity, by studying macroscopic phenomena. So it's very important from quantum gravity phenomenology to keep in mind that sometime quantum shows up in macro. Okay? And so this doesn't have to be overlooked. On the technical side and on the phenomenological perspective, macroscopic bodies can be a blessing when, in your theory, they create opportunity like superconductivity. So when occasionally you have a macroscopic body where the quantum gravity or the quantum space-time effects get amplified, then you set up your experiment to discover that, and you're bang, Nobel Prize. Could be disastrous, however. You should not get too excited. It can be disastrous if you have generic amplification of quantum space-time and quantum gravity effects for macroscopic bodies. This is for obvious reasons. Macroscopic bodies are pretty large. So if you have generic amplification of quantum gravity effects for macroscopic bodies, probably your theory is ruled out, which is one of the most honorable things that can happen to you, but second place to it being discovered. You would be wrong, which is about a billion times better than not being wrong, not being even wrong, but still not as good as being right. What I'm excited about, although I'll have to criticize these experiments, is that being wrong in science is pretty good. There's only one thing better than being wrong. I'll advertise some experiments. I mean, the thing is going. I mean, there is people thinking about experiments with macroscopic bodies. Good journals are publishing these ideas. I think these ideas are less promising than it may appear, but nonetheless, I'm very excited about the ideas and the developments around
it. What about the mechanical stuff that people do related to LIGO? Yeah. Okay.
This one is the optomechanical. Well, all of these measurements have a feature. They focus on the motion of the center of mass of a macroscopic body. So I'll have to close in 1 minute to stress that this is not the most promising opportunity for this phenomenology, but I'm nonetheless excited that these ideas are being proposed and tested, because there is nothing better than data. I would have a fancy way to explain to you many interesting things about macroscopic bodies using the language that has been very popular in this session, curved momentum space. With Laurent, Lee, and Jurek, we have had a first paper on macroscopic bodies on a curved momentum space. Then Sabine wrote a, let's say, informal but intriguing comment on our work that led us to notice gained further insight on macroscopic or on a momentum space. I think what we are learning through this work with Laurent, Jurek, and Lee is that, well, maybe on the curved momentum space we are in the best case scenario. So the amplification for macroscopic body is not generic, but there is a chance to find special cases where we have the amplification, and then phenomenology will have a big chance. Let me just close in 1 minute to, instead of doing that, I will advertise my simpler, I stumbled upon a simpler argument to explain this thing of the macroscopic body. So I stress, certain observables for certain macroscopic body in certain contexts are very likely the way in which we will discover quantum gravity. But I'm going to stress once again that the center of mass motion of a macroscopic body, which is relevant for these naive arguments on the soccer ball problem and for these experimental proposals, which are not naive, but they have, in my opinion, very limited chance of success, the center of mass of macroscopic body is not a very promising observable. And let me just show you. So this was the soccer ball problem. With naive arguments, you could convince yourself that the center of mass of macroscopic body would acquire very weird properties, an amplification of the properties of the constituents. So let me just propose, I have an even simpler argument than,
than previous ones we have proposed. So let me just describe a macroscopic, the center of mass of a macroscopic body with some center of mass coordinates. The constituents have all the same mass for simplicity. A total momentum like this. And let me, for example, use Lie algebra non-commutativity. Well, first, no. First, let me show you. Okay, this description of coordinates and momenta of the macroscopic center of mass with respect to the constituents, it's interesting. It's obvious, but it's probably not stressed enough. In the non-commutative geometry we do have, the one of ordinary quantum mechanics, the quantum phase space of quantum mechanics, is stable under this. So if you commute center of mass coordinate with center of mass momentum, you get the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, just like for the constituents. Okay? This n in the denominator that you need for the center of mass coordinates just balances out. And of course, we never stress that because then we have decoherence. And so this goes, you know, this goes under the decoherence curtain. But now let's see if quantum spacetime could be the same. Could macroscopic bodies have the same properties, the coordinate of center of mass as its constituents? Or actually have amplified quantum properties, as some naive arguments on the Sokolov problem suggested? Well, it's easy to convince yourself. You know, this is a commutator. Oh, I jumped my preferred one. Let me first do the. I'll do only the preferred one. So let me write a Lie algebra commutator. So x, y gives you some other coordinates. And let me use then, this is for the constituents. Let me now check what happens for the center of mass coordinates of the macroscopic body. It's just the simplest commutator calculation you can do. You see that for the center of mass coordinates of a macroscopic body, the non-commutative scale gets corrected by 1 over n. So contrary to the Sokolov problem, the coordinates of a macroscopic body, contrary to the naive arguments on the Sokolov problem, the coordinate of a macroscopic body not only don't have more non-commutativity than the constituents, they have far less. And interestingly, this L over n is what Laurent, Jurek, and I found in the dual picture of momentum space. Do you realize that this is just exactly the space-time non-commutativity counterpart to our first paper on this story? And you can play this game with Moyal non-commutativity, where this is constant. Again, it's easy to see that the center of mass coordinates are affected by non-commutativity in ways suppressed by 1 over n. And even if you play the game with the deformed Heisenberg, which was also mentioned in this meeting, they get suppressed by 1 over n. So this is my summary of what I said. But since it was not such a long journey, I will perhaps not say it all. And instead, I will thank Flavio. We should all thank Flavio for organizing this big meeting. He's very successful. I have a present. I have a present for Flavio since he was. Since he was so good in organizing the meeting, this is Flavio's favorite soccer player, and I think I should honor him with this picture. Actually, a player that played for two wonderful teams, first for Napoli and then for Juventus eventually, yeah, later on in his career. Thank you, Flavio, very much.
Questions? Well, you said that it's very nice and very new that we have to deal both with understanding the lab and the load, in fact. But first, I'm not sure this is very new, because, I mean, in the past, when we saw something strange in the orbits of planets, once it was explained by assuming the existence of another planet, so changing the lab, and once it was understood by changing the laws, going from Newton to GR. So I don't think this is new. But more importantly, I don't think this is nice. Because, I mean, this is a nightmare. For example, when looking for dark matter, you know, there was a lot of excitement because of this excess of positrons. And then we understood that it is most probably due to astrophysical effect because these pulsars.
Nice and nightmare for me are equivalent.
No, so my question is, do you really think that we have some hope that in near future or seeable future, we can understand the sources well enough to test something else than the sources themselves? We know.
Oh, yes, already now. I mean, already now what Bolmont and Granot told us is that we are nonetheless getting out something. The problem is that we get out far less
than we would get if we understood the sources better. This is, but it's not that we don't learn anything. And so we are learning much less than we could, and this is frustrating, and that's why I say nice, because I'm doing this work because not for success, for frustration, and I think imagine if every question you asked, after 10 seconds you knew the answer. That's a nightmare for a scientist, I guess. You don't want to know the answer. So that's why I'm here, and that's what you want to do is, I want to know the answer. Boom, the answer arrives. That's a nightmare.
It would be nice to have rich phenomenology, you would agree, right?
Well, I wouldn't change what it is. Fine. It's bad enough for me. But it's interesting what you said. It's very fair. The volcano story. Yes, that's very fair. I mean, maybe it's not so new in
no,
that
these
comparison.
People really care. It's not important whether it's new or not.
But I don't think you need to you can dominate, you can marginalize your ignorance of the sources. That will create a barrier for, you know, how much you can understand, but you still learn something. It's not like, because I don't understand the sources, I don't look at telescope data anymore. You know, I will look at it, and knowing that every time I see a feature, it could be a feature of the source, and I have to do this intriguing investigative work. We have some handles, the redshift dependence of effects, especially for space-time research, the point two of my item. The sources are trouble, but you could fight in the long run, because a space-time effect is qualitatively different from an effect at the source. You have the point that you look for the distance dependence of the type that your theory predicts. So you have handles. Of course, the time becomes very long for something that could have taken a much shorter time. That's why I say nice.
And if you assume that something, for example, that whose legs are due to quantum space-time effect, and if you use this modified dispersion relation in the cosmological sector, have you checked if this can change something in the power spectrum, the mirror power spectrum?
No. Well, if they are at such low scale, they could only be DSR relativistic. They couldn't be LIV. I don't know if you followed, because LIV is really excluded not only by other data that Lee mentioned and reminded me about, but also by cross-section, by the fact that the cosmic ray spectrum works. So it should be DSR. And DSR cosmology is still with Joao and Julia, we are discussing it, but this is indeed a question very fair that we are thinking of.
More questions? If not, let's thank.